Alistair, the 8th Duke of Blackwood, stared at the number with a kind of bloodless horror. It was not a particularly large number in the grand scheme of his holdings, but it was a negative one, and it sat at the bottom of a long column of other negative numbers, a final, damning verdict on a year of frantic effort. The ledger, bound in worn calfskin, seemed to mock him from its position on the vast mahogany desk that had belonged to his father and his father's father. They had never contended with such persistent, insidious red ink. "It is the drainage in the east pasture, Your Grace," Mr. Hobbs said, his voice as dry and weathered as the ancient deeds he curated. The estate steward stood by the window, his silhouette a rigid line against the graying afternoon light. "And the wool contract your father signed with the Merryweathers. It is, if you will forgive the term, ruinous." Alistair forgave the term. He would have forgiven much stronger language. He felt the phantom weight of his father's debts settling upon his shoulders, a familiar cloak of inherited anxiety. His father had been a man of grand gestures and poor arithmetic, a combination that had left Blackwood Manor beautiful, mortgaged, and bleeding coin from 1,000 small cuts. "Ashworth has sent another note," Alistair said, pushing the ledger away. He did not need to see it to feel its contents branded on his mind. "He is no longer asking to buy Blackwood Forest. He is beginning to phrase it as a necessity." Hobbs turned from the window. His face was a study in loyal disapproval. "Lord Ashworth is a vulture who mistakes a sick cow for a dead one. The estate is not dead yet. But it is certainly unwell, Hobbs. We both know it." This was the state of things when the solution arrived, not in the form of a miraculous harvest or a long-lost inheritance, but as a proposition from his solicitor. The solution had a name, Miss Eleanor Ainsworth. Her father, a recently deceased academic of some obscure renown, had left her with an impressive education and a pathetically unimpressive portfolio. What she did have, however, was a dowry. It was not a duke's ransom, but it was comprised of solid, unencumbered capital. It was liquid. It was immediate. It was enough to silence Lord Ashworth for a season, to repair the drainage in the east pasture, to breathe. The marriage was arranged with the bloodless efficiency of a corporate merger. Alistair met her once, in her aunt's suffocatingly genteel London drawing room. He registered a young woman who was neither plain nor beautiful, who dressed in a modest gray that seemed designed to help her fade into the damask wallpaper. She was quiet. Her eyes, a startlingly clear shade of hazel, seemed to absorb everything without comment. He noted her stillness, her composure, and filed her away in his mind under the heading, suitable, manageable, uncomplicated. He did not consider love or even affection. He was purchasing a reprieve, and in return she would receive a title and the security of his name. It was a transaction, clean and necessary. He was a man of logic, of duty, and the preservation of Blackwood was his highest, most sacred obligation. His heart had no place in the ledger. Eleanor Ainsworth understood the arrangement with a clarity that would have surprised her future husband. She saw the desperation behind his cool, aristocratic composure. She saw the faint lines of worry etched around his eyes. During their brief, formal meeting, she had not looked at the fine furnishings of the room. She had looked at the worn cuffs on his jacket, a small, telling detail that spoke more of his situation than any solicitor's letter. She was the daughter of a man who believed the universe could be understood through numbers. He had taught her calculus before she could properly embroider. He had explained the principles of crop rotation using her dollhouse garden. He had left her with a mind that saw patterns and systems in everything, and very little else. She was a quiet creature, not from shyness, but from a habit of intense observation. To speak was to cease listening, to cease seeing, and there was always so much to see. So she agreed to the marriage. She packed her two modest trunks, her father's books on botany and economics, and a small, well-used abacus. She was an asset being liquidated to cover a liability. She understood this. She felt no particular sentiment about it. It was simply the next logical step in the equation of her life. She would become the Duchess of Blackwood, a title that felt as foreign and ill-fitting as a borrowed gown. Their wedding was a quiet affair, attended by only the most necessary of relatives. Alistair was perfectly correct, perfectly distant. He performed his role with flawless precision. Standing beside him at the altar, Eleanor was acutely aware of him as a collection of attributes: his height, the severe line of his jaw, the scent of cedar and clean linen. He was a problem to be solved, like the failing estate he embodied. And she, it seemed, was to be the temporary solution. 2 days after she became the Duchess of Blackwood, she made her first request. She found him in the same library where he had first despaired over the ledgers. The room smelled of old paper and beeswax. "Your Grace," she began, her voice even and low. It was the first time she had initiated a conversation with him. He looked up from a map of the county, his expression one of polite, mild surprise. He had, he realized, almost forgotten she was in the house. She moved with a quietness that rendered her nearly invisible. "Duchess," he responded, inclining his head. "I should like to see the estate ledgers," she said. Alistair blinked. Of all the things he had expected his new wife to request, a redecoration of her rooms, an allowance for a new wardrobe, a trip to London, this was the least probable. He felt a flicker of something he could only describe as bemused irritation. "The ledgers?" he repeated, as if she had misspoken. "Yes, for the last 5 years, if it is not too much trouble." He almost smiled. The idea was absurd. What could this quiet, gray little mouse of a woman possibly understand of such things? It was a whim, a flight of fancy from a woman with too much time on her hands. "They are quite dense," he said, a gentle note of dismissal in his tone. "I would not wish to bore you." "I am not easily bored," she replied. Her gaze was direct, unwavering. It held no challenge, only a simple statement of fact. He found himself momentarily disarmed. It was easier to dismiss a request than to deny it outright. It would be an amusing little hobby for her, he supposed, a way to occupy her days while he dealt with the serious business of saving their home. "Very well," he said, waving a hand in a gesture of magnanimous concession. "I shall have Hobbs bring them to you." He expected her to take them to the morning room, to flutter through them for an afternoon before abandoning them for a novel or some needlepoint. He was wrong. Hobbs delivered the heavy, dust-laden volumes to her personal study, a small, overlooked room she had chosen for its excellent morning light. And there she remained. For days. She did not emerge for social calls. She took her meals on a tray at her desk. The household staff, accustomed to the languid indolence of the previous Duchess, whispered with curiosity. Alistair saw her only at dinner. She would appear as the clock chimed the hour, dressed in another of her simple, elegant gowns. She was polite. She inquired about his day. She made pleasant, if minimal, conversation. But her mind, he sensed, was elsewhere. It was in the columns of ink, in the calculus of their ruin. Section. After the fourth day, Hobbs sought him out. The steward's face wore an expression of profound confusion. "Her Grace, the Duchess," he began, then paused. "She has questions." "Questions?" Alistair asked, distracted by a letter he was drafting to his banker. "Indeed. She wishes to know why we are selling our wool unwashed to the Merryweathers at a fixed price, when the London market price for cleaned fleece has risen by 20% in the last 18 months. She also inquired about the discrepancy between the seed allotment for the Northfields and the recorded yield for the last 3 harvests. Alistair put down his pen. The questions were not the vague, ill-informed queries of an amateur. They were specific. They were pointed. They were precisely the kinds of questions he should have been asking himself, had he not been so consumed with the larger, more existential threats. He felt an unwelcome prickle of something. It was not annoyance. It was closer to surprise, a recalibration of his initial assessment. "What did you tell her?" he asked. "The truth, Your Grace, that the Merryweather contract was a convenience, and that we suspect a portion of the Northfield grain is being pilfered before it reaches the granary." "And her response?" "She made a note in a small book," Hobbs said, looking utterly bewildered. "And then she asked for the tenant contracts and the last decade's rainfall measurements." Alistair was silent for a long moment. He looked at the closed door of his wife's study. For the first time, he wondered what, precisely, was happening in that room. He felt a flicker of curiosity, but it was quickly extinguished by the pressing weight of his own duties. It was a curiosity, nothing more. An anomaly. The moment that changed everything came a week later. It was unintentional, an accident of timing and acoustics. Alistair was in the main hall with Hobbs, discussing the necessity of selling a small parcel of land to cover the quarter's wages. The conversation was grim, the options limited. "Lord Ashworth will not wait forever," Alistair said, his voice tight with frustration. "We need capital, Hobbs, now." "Perhaps if we waited until after the harvest," the steward began, but Alistair cut him off. "There is no time." He paced the length of the marble floor, the sound of his boots echoing in the cavernous space. He felt the walls of his inheritance closing in. He felt trapped. It was then that Hobbs, with a hesitant cough, broached the subject that had been troubling him. "And the Duchess, Your Grace? She has been spending a great deal of time on the accounts. I am concerned her interference might complicate matters." Alistair stopped pacing. He glanced toward the grand staircase. He thought of his quiet wife, hidden away with her ledgers and her strange questions. A wave of weariness and condescension washed over him. He was trying to hold back the ocean with a teacup, and his steward was worried about a woman dabbling in arithmetic. The absurdity of it all struck him. He gave a short, humorless laugh. "Hobbs, let her be. She needs a hobby. It keeps her occupied." He turned to face the steward, his voice resonating with the casual, unthinking authority of his station. "Let her try," he said, the words echoing slightly in the high-ceilinged hall. "What harm can a woman with an abacus do?" He did not see the figure at the top of the stairs. He did not see the shadow that paused in the gallery, half hidden by a suit of armor. Eleanor had been on her way to the library to fetch a book on soil composition. She heard their voices and had stopped, not wanting to interrupt, and so she heard it all. "She needs a hobby. Let her try. What harm can a woman with an abacus do?" The words did not strike her with heat or fury. There was no sudden rush of anger, no sting of tears. Instead, A profound and terrible coldness settled deep within her. It was the coldness of absolute certainty, the coldness of a mathematical proof arriving at its inevitable, unassailable conclusion. She had known their marriage was a transaction. She had accepted it. But she had not understood until that exact moment the depth of his dismissal. He did not see her as a partner, or even as a person of consequence. He saw her as a decorative object that needed to be kept occupied. Her efforts, her mind, her days spent poring over his family's failings, they were, to him, a hobby, a quaint little pastime. Something inside her shifted. It was not a violent break, but a quiet, decisive click, like a lock settling into place. A door, one she hadn't even known was open, swung shut. She turned without a sound and walked back to her study. She did not fetch the book on soil. She sat at her desk and looked at the neat columns of figures she had drawn up. She looked at the pages of notes, the calculations, the strategies she had begun to formulate. Before, she had been working to understand the problem of Blackwood. She had assumed, on some level, that she was doing it for them, for the good of the house she now belonged to, for the man whose name she now carried. Now, she was doing it for herself. Her work was no longer a contribution. It was an answer. It was a rebuttal to his dismissive question. She would show him exactly what harm or good a woman with an abacus could do. But he would not be a collaborator in her success. He would be a spectator. He would see the results, but he would not be privy to the process. She would save his estate, not as his duchess, but as a silent, invisible force he had so carelessly underestimated. She would turn his loss into a profit, and he would never know precisely how until it was already done. The change was subtle at first. Alistair was too consumed by his negotiations with Ashworth to notice the subtle shifts within his own household. But the shifts were occurring. Eleanor began to meet with Hobbs every morning, not in the grand library, but in the small, dusty estate office that had been unused for years. She did not give orders. She asked questions and made suggestions. "Mr. Hobbs," she would say, pointing to a line in the wool contract. "The Merryweathers have their own scouring facilities. If we were to wash the fleece ourselves before sale, would our initial costs be offset by the higher market price?" Or, "I have reviewed the tenant contracts for the northern farms. The yields are consistently low. Is it possible the soil is depleted? My father's books suggest a rotation with clover could replenish the nitrogen within 2 seasons. Hobbs, a man accustomed to decades of ducal commands, found himself in the unfamiliar position of engaging in a dialogue. He was a practical man, and her suggestions were practical. More than that, they were astute. He began to see her not as the Duke's flighty new wife, but as a mind of formidable clarity. He started bringing her problems, not just ledgers. He became her willing, if slightly bewildered, co-conspirator. Alistair, meanwhile, began to notice things at a remove. He noticed, for instance, that the meals served at dinner had improved in quality, a surprising development given that he had recently instructed the housekeeper to enforce stricter economies. He commented on it one evening. "The lamb is excellent, Duchess," he said, more to fill the silence than anything else. The silences between them had grown longer, more profound. "I am pleased you think so," she replied, her expression placid. "The housekeeper discovered our usual purveyor was overcharging us. She has found a new one." He did not think to ask who, precisely, had prompted the housekeeper to review the purveyor's invoices. He noticed that the mood among the tenants seemed lighter. On his rides around the estate, he received fewer sullen glares and more respectful nods. He attributed it to the changing seasons, a good omen for the harvest. He did not know that Eleanor, through Hobbs, had restructured several of the most onerous tenant agreements, trading a portion of their rent for a commitment to help repair the estate's drainage ditches, a project that benefited everyone. It was a simple, elegant solution that required no capital, only a shift in perspective. The most significant change he noticed, however, was in Eleanor herself. It was not a change so much as an absence. She was present at his table. She was present at church on Sunday. She fulfilled her duties as Duchess with a cool, flawless efficiency. She was present, and she was absent. She was there, and she was not there. Her quietness had once seemed to him a sign of a placid, uncomplicated nature. Now it felt like a wall, a smooth, polished, impenetrable barrier. He would ask about her day, and she would give him a brief, courteous summary of her activities. A walk in the garden, some correspondence, reading. She never mentioned the ledgers, she never mentioned the estate office, she never mentioned the hours she spent with Hobbs, reshaping the destiny of his home. He found himself watching her. He tried to reconcile the quiet woman across the dining table with the person who had asked Hobbs about nitrogen replenishment. The two images did not align. He felt a growing sense of unease, a feeling that he was missing a crucial piece of a puzzle he hadn't even known existed. He was the Duke. This was his estate. And yet, he had the distinct impression that the true work of Blackwood was happening in rooms he never entered, in conversations he was not a party to. His own efforts were yielding nothing but frustration. Ashworth was circling, his letters growing more demanding. The bankers in London were polite but firm. Alistair felt as though he were wrestling with a giant, while somewhere in the house, a clock was being taken apart, cleaned, and reassembled, piece by tiny, intricate piece. He could hear the faint, orderly ticking, but he could not find its source. The end of the quarter arrived like a day of judgment. Alistair sat at his desk, the same desk where he had despaired 3 months prior, and braced himself for the final, damning figures from Hobbs. He expected to see the culmination of their slow decline, the number that would finally force him to sell Blackwood Forest. Hobbs entered, but his demeanor was different. The usual grim resignation was gone, replaced by something Alistair could not immediately identify. It looked, improbably, like satisfaction. "Your Grace," the steward said, placing a single sheet of paper on the desk. It was not one of the heavy ledgers, but a summary sheet, the figures written in a clear, precise hand that Alistair did not recognize. He picked it up. He read the top line. He read it again. He looked at the bottom line, the final calculation of profit and loss for the quarter. The number was not red. It was black. It was not a large number. It would not, by itself, save them. But it existed. For the first time in nearly a decade, Blackwood had turned a profit. A small, miraculous, impossible profit. Alistair stared at the paper, his mind refusing to process the information. It was a mistake. A clerical error. He looked up at Hobbs, a question in his eyes. "How?" he asked. The word came out as a whisper. Hobbs stood a little straighter. The moment he had been waiting for had arrived. "A series of new efficiencies, Your Grace, and the renegotiation of several key contracts." "What efficiencies? Who renegotiated?" Alistair demanded, his voice rising. He had approved no such measures. He had been so consumed with the macro problem of Ashworth that he had failed to see the micro solutions. And then Hobbs delivered the blow. It was not a malicious blow, but it struck Alastair with the force of a physical impact. "The Duchess," Hobbs said, his voice imbued with a deep and genuine respect. Her grace identified the waste in the household accounts. She devised the new drainage plan with the tenants. She found the clause in the Merryweather agreement that allowed for a price review and wrote the letter herself. She has a mind for systems, Your Grace. She found efficiencies we have overlooked for 20 years. The Duchess, Eleanor. The room seemed to tilt. Every disconnected observation of the past 3 months crashed into place with the force of a tidal wave. The improved meals, the happier tenants, her long hours in the study, her strange technical questions, her impenetrable reserve. And then, with a sickening, gut-wrenching clarity, he heard his own voice echoing in the vast emptiness of the main hall. "She needs a hobby. Let her try. What harm can a woman with an abacus do?" He felt a flush of shame so hot and so profound it nearly took his breath away. She had heard him. Of course, she had heard him. That was the day the wall had gone up. That was the day she had ceased to be his wife in any meaningful sense and had become something else, an independent operator within his own home. He had dismissed her, and she had responded not with tears or hysterics, but with cold, brilliant, devastating competence. He looked down at the summary sheet again. The neat, elegant script was hers. This paper was not a report. It was a verdict. It was her quiet, irrefutable judgment on his arrogance, his blindness. He had married a woman of extraordinary talent and treated her like a decorative accessory. He hadn't just failed to see her. He had actively chosen not to look. The profit on the page felt like the deepest loss of his life. He had won a temporary reprieve for his estate, but he understood with chilling certainty that he had lost his wife. He had possessed her name, her dowry, her physical presence, but he had never, for one moment, possessed her respect. And now, he knew he did not deserve it. "Where is she?" he asked, his voice hoarse. "In the estate office, Your Grace," Hobbs replied. "She is reviewing the timber yields." Alistair stood up. He left the summary sheet on his desk, a testament to his own monumental folly. He walked out of the library, through the main hall where he had uttered those fateful, foolish words, and down a corridor he had not entered in years. The estate office was a small, functional room at the back of the house. It had been his grandfather's domain, a place of work, not leisure. For decades, it had been a repository for old maps and forgotten files. Now, it was transformed. It was organized. It was alive. One wall was covered with a large map of the estate, crisscrossed with colored pins and fine pencil lines. A bookshelf, once dusty, now held neatly arranged volumes. And at the center of it all, at a simple wooden table, sat Eleanor. She was bent over a chart, her brow furrowed in concentration. A stray strand of hair had escaped its pin and fallen across her cheek. The morning light from the window illuminated the dust motes dancing in the air around her, making her seem both ethereal and intensely real. This was her space, her sanctuary, her war room. He stood in the doorway, and for the first time, he felt like an intruder in his own home. She must have sensed his presence because she looked up. Her expression was not surprised, merely questioning. Her face was a placid mask, revealing nothing of her thoughts. He had come here to... what? To demand an explanation? To assert his authority? The very idea seemed ludicrous now. What authority did he have left? She had demonstrated a mastery of his affairs that far surpassed his own. So he told the truth. The only thing he had left He did not move from the doorway. He did not try to enter her space. He simply stood there and let the silence stretch until it was taut with unspoken meaning. "I saw the quarterly report," he said finally. His voice sounded unnaturally loud in the quiet room. She inclined her head slightly, a gesture of acknowledgement. She did not speak. She waited. "Hobbs told me it was your work." Another slight nod. Still, she said nothing. She was making him do the work. She was making him bridge the chasm he himself had created. He took a breath. "I was wrong." The words hung in the air between them. It was not an apology. Not yet. It was a confession. A statement of fact as clear and undeniable as the figures on her summary sheet. "I was arrogant," he continued, the words coming more easily now, a torrent of overdue admission. "And I was blind. I heard what I said to Hobbs that day, in my mind. I heard it just now. And I finally understood." He saw a flicker of something in her eyes. It was not forgiveness. It was the first crack in the ice. "I married you as a solution to a problem, Eleanor. A transaction. I never took the time to see the woman I had bound myself to. I looked at you, but I never saw you." He paused, the weight of his own ignorance pressing down on him. "And that was the most ruinous miscalculation of all." He did not ask for her forgiveness. He knew he had no right to it. He simply stood there, having laid his foolishness bare, and waited for her judgment. Eleanor looked at him. She saw the shame in his eyes, the genuine contrition in the set of his shoulders. She had expected this confrontation eventually. She had rehearsed a dozen cold, cutting replies. But hearing the simple, unadorned admission, "I was wrong, I was blind," disarmed her. She rose from her chair. She did not move toward him, but she picked up a piece of paper from her desk. "Lord Ashworth will likely make another offer for the forest," she said, her voice calm and businesslike, as if they were discussing the weather. "He will see our improved position as a temporary fluke. He will try to press his advantage now, before we can consolidate." Alistair was momentarily thrown. She had not acknowledged his confession. She had moved directly to strategy. And in doing so, she had given him the smallest of openings. She was not shutting him out completely. She was testing him. "What do you suggest?" he asked, accepting the opening, stepping into the role of a student. "We cannot afford to seem weak or divided," she said. "He is expected to call tomorrow afternoon. You will receive him, and I will be with you." The next day, Lord Ashworth arrived precisely as Eleanor had predicted. He was a portly man with a predatory smile and an air of unearned confidence. He was shown into the main library, where Alistair waited for him. But Alistair was not alone. The Duchess sat in a chair near the fireplace, a book open in her lap. She was not part of the conversation, yet her presence changed its entire dynamic. Ashworth began with oily pleasantries before moving to the purpose of his visit. "Blackwood, my dear fellow, I have heard rumors of a temporary improvement in your finances. Excellent news, but we both know these things can be fleeting. My offer for the forest still stands. It is generous. It would solve all your problems." Alistair remained standing. He did not offer his guest a drink. "The finances of my estate are no longer a subject for public speculation, Ashworth," he said, his voice cold. "And Blackwood Forest is not for sale." Ashworth chuckled. "Come now. Don't let a single good harvest go to your head. You cannot sustain this. I am offering you a lifeline." "I find we are no longer in need of one," Alistair replied. He picked up the quarterly summary from his desk, Eleanor's summary. our projections for the next two quarters are sound. In fact, we are considering an investment in a new sawmill to better manage our own timber resources. It was a bluff, but a brilliant one. He saw the idea register in Eleanor's eyes. She gave a nearly imperceptible nod of approval. Ashworth's smile faltered. He glanced at Eleanor, who looked up from her book as if just noticing the conversation. "The Duchess has been conducting a thorough analysis of our assets," Alistair said, deliberately drawing her in. "Her calculations suggest that the long-term value of the processed timber from the forest far exceeds any short-term gain from a sale. Is that not correct, my dear?" He had deferred to her, publicly, in front of their chief antagonist. It was an abdication of his sole authority and an open declaration of her role. It was an act of atonement. Eleanor closed her book. "Lord Ashworth," she said, her voice clear and steady, "your offer values the timber at less than two-thirds of its current market price. And that does not even account for the value of the land itself or the watershed it protects for our tenants. From a purely financial perspective, it would be an exceptionally poor decision for us to accept." Her words were not an opinion. They were a statement of fact, delivered with the quiet authority of someone who had done the work, who knew the numbers inside and out. Lord Ashworth was speechless. He had come to bully a desperate duke. He had not expected to face a calm, analytical duchess who could dismantle his argument with a few well-chosen sentences. He sputtered, blustered, and, seeing he had lost all leverage, made a hasty retreat. When the door closed behind him, the silence in the library was different. It was no longer a space of tension, but one of shared victory. Alistair looked at Eleanor. "A new sawmill," he asked, a hint of a smile playing on his lips. "The initial outlay would be significant," she said, her expression serious. "But the return on investment could be realized within 5 years. I will draw up the projections." She had not forgiven him, not yet, but she had allowed him onto the battlefield with her. She had accepted him as an ally. It was a start. The rebuilding of their marriage was a slow, quiet process. It was not built on grand declarations or romantic gestures, but on small, consistent acts of attention and respect. Alistair began to court his own wife. He did not send her flowers. He brought her a newly published treatise on agricultural economics he had found in a London bookshop. He did not write her poetry. He spent his afternoons walking the estate with her, listening as she explained her plans for the fields, the tenants, the forest. He learned to see the land not just as his birthright, but as a complex, living system. He learned to see it through her eyes. He started to notice the small things about her that his earlier blindness had obscured. He noticed the way she chewed on the end of her pen when she was deep in thought. He noticed the rare, genuine smile that transformed her face when one of her plans came to fruition. He noticed the intelligence that shone in her eyes, an intelligence he now realized was the most beautiful thing about her. He fell in love with her slowly, and then all at once. It was a humbling, terrifying, and exhilarating experience. He was in love with the woman he had so profoundly misjudged. Eleanor, for her part, watched him. She observed his efforts with the same analytical mind she applied to the estate ledgers. She saw the consistency. She saw the sincerity. The cold, hard wall around her heart began to thaw. She had married for security, never expecting companionship, let alone love. She had guarded herself against disappointment by expecting nothing. But this new Alistair, this humble, attentive, intelligent man, was a variable she had not anticipated. She found herself seeking his opinion, valuing his perspective. He had a strategic mind for dealing with the neighboring gentry that complemented her own analytical skills. They began to work together, a true partnership. He was the public face of Blackwood, its authority and its strength. She was its private mind, its strategist, and its heart. The rumors started by a bitter Lord Ashworth were quickly quashed. The tenants, loyal to a duke and duchess who had treated them with fairness and respect, presented a united front. At the annual harvest festival, Alistair and Eleanor stood together to greet their people. They were not just a duke and his duchess. They were a team. Their success was palpable, a tangible thing that radiated from the thriving fields and the contented faces of their tenants. One evening, months later, they were working late in the estate office. The room was bathed in the warm glow of an oil lamp. Papers and maps were spread across the table, evidence of their shared work, their shared future. Alistair stopped what he was doing and simply looked at her. She was tracing a line on a map, her expression one of complete absorption, and in that moment, his heart felt so full, he thought it might break. "Eleanor," he said, his voice quiet. She looked up, her finger still on the map. "I love you," he said. It was not a grand declaration, but a simple, profound truth. "I love your mind. I love your strength. I love the way you see the world. This estate, it was just land and buildings before you came. You made it a home. You saved it. And you saved me." She held his gaze, and for the first time, he saw no reserve, no wall, no calculation. He saw only her, the brilliant, resilient, extraordinary woman he had almost lost through his own foolish pride. She gave him one of her rare, true smiles. "Well," she said, a hint of dry wit in her tone, "it was a sound investment, after all." A year later, the estate office was still the heart of Blackwood Manor, but it was not the only place where life flourished. The east pasture, once a soggy ruin, was now lush and green. The tenants were prosperous. The sawmill, once a bluff, was under construction by the river. And in the long-neglected west garden, Eleanor, now visibly expecting their first child, directed the planting of new rose bushes. The garden, like the estate, had been beautiful but mismanaged, its potential choked by years of neglect. Under her care, it was being reborn. Alistair stood on the terrace, watching her. He saw her pause to press a hand to her stomach, a small, private smile on her face. The late afternoon sun caught the gold in her hair, and he felt the same overwhelming sense of love and gratitude he had felt in the estate office. He thought back to that first year. He thought of his blindness, his arrogance. He had been a man staring at a locked treasure chest, complaining about his poverty, all the while holding the key in his hand, and not even recognizing what it was for. The key had been her, her mind, her worth. He had almost thrown it away. He had learned the hardest and most important lesson of his life, that true value is not always announced with a trumpet. Sometimes it is quiet. Sometimes it is overlooked. Sometimes it sits patiently in a dusty room with an abacus waiting to be seen. He had learned, finally, how to see, and in doing so, he had gained everything.